Hello, and welcome to the show today. Just before I started recording this intro about an hour ago, and I've been on the internet ever since watching the live feed, was the news that former Blue Jays ace Roy Halladay was killed in a plane crash just off of St. Petersburg in the Gulf Coast. He was flying it, and he was the only one in. So it's, all of us here in Toronto and all of us who were Blue Jays fans are figuring out how to process this, how to deal with this. He was definitely one of not only the best pitchers of all time, but probably one of the top five people to ever put on a Blue Jays uniform. So that's what's happening right now. I'm gonna try to have a tribute, either a tribute show on Friday, or at least someone who can come and talk about Roy and his legacy and his career. So hopefully that will happen in the future. But I don't necessarily feel like doing a huge intro today, other than to say we have three great guests on the show. We have comedian Gad Elmaleh, who's talking about making the transition from performing in French to performing in English. And he will be in Toronto on the 11th, followed by dates in Winnipeg. Also, we have Matthew Charbonneau from the band Timber Tambor on their new album, Sincerely Future Pollution. And all the way from Berlin, Germany, we have performance artist Vaginal Davis, who is featured in a new exhibit at the New Museum of New York entitled Trigger, Gender as a Tool and as a Weapon. That's all coming up on today's show. My first guest has been called the Jerry Seinfeld of France. He made history by selling out the prestigious Olympia Theatre Hall in Paris for seven consecutive weeks, and then followed that with another sold out 7 weeks at the Palais des Sports, a 3,800 seat venue also in Paris. He is performing in comedy clubs in Europe for years, but recently made the transition to the US and performing in English. His most recent Netflix special, Gad Gone Wild, was performed in both English and French, and he's currently working on a new English-only special. In addition to his successful comedy career, he's also appeared in such movies as The Adventures of Tintin, directed by Steven Spielberg, and appeared opposite Owen Wilson and Rachel McAdams in Woody Allen's Midnight in Paris. He's also appeared in The Midnight Orchestra, Capital, Les Seigneurs, Happiness Never Comes Alone, Jack and Jill, and Coco, as well as appearing in Getting in Cars with Coffee. In addition to French and English, he also speaks Arabic and Hebrew. He is Gad Elmaleh, and he joined me the other day to talk about his career. Gad Elmaleh, hello, bonjour, welcome to the show.
Hello, thanks for having me. Bonjour. How is your French, by the way?
Comme ci, comme ça. Il n'y a pas pratiqué longtemps, but...
Oh, that's not bad. You know what's funny with Canadians? When you ask them if they know French, they'll all say, I took 2 years of French in high school, but I forgot it all.
That's, yeah.
And it's interesting, because 2 years is a lot.
Well, you know what? Especially on the west coast of Canada, most people don't know French, but if you come closer out here, like Toronto, Montreal, Ottawa, a lot of people speak French.
Yeah. That's right.
So you're originally from Paris, and you...
Yeah, no, originally, I have to say...
Well, Casablanca,
I'm originally from Morocco.
Yes.
I was born and raised in Morocco, in Casablanca, and then I moved... By the way, I moved to Canada in 1988 for 4 years, and I lived in Montreal.
That's right, you studied
at... And then I moved... Yeah.
You studied at McGill, right?
Spent 20 France, and now I just moved to the U.S.
The decision for you, you were very successful. You had a great European career. You were playing sold out shows in big venues in Paris. The decision to move to the U.S. to do a new challenge. What prompted that decision for you?
I think important thing for me was to be excited again by my job. Not that I was bored in France, and I'm so thankful to my fans for years they've been. But I have to say that, and it's how I am. I need challenges, and I need to be challenged, and I had the whole American dream thing in my mind, but very deep personal project, really a passion, really it to be, you know, able to, I mean, to try to step out of this comfort that I had in France, as you said, performing in my fans and being time, and then it's fantastic, and I love that, and I'm very grateful. But I love the idea of going on a stage where you don't know me, and you know, I feel like I'm earning these laughs, and I work harder, and they have no expectations because they don't know me. And there's nothing better than going in a club in New York or in Toronto, or and just go on and try jokes, and wow, when they laugh, I feel like they love me for who I am as a comic. Just as if a girl who doesn't know I'm famous would fall in love with me, I would be so flattered and you know, happy. and the crazy thing is, when I go on stage in English, the little nervous I have is the same that I had when I first started 20 years ago in French. That's crazy.
Is that part of the reason you sort of made the transition to performing in a lot more smaller, intimate comedy clubs? Is there a different type of relationship that occurs with the audience when that happens?
Yeah, totally. Because for two reasons. The first one is, I need to work out on my material, and this is what they do in North America, whether Canada or the U.S. That's what comedians here do. They work hard, and I love that. I'm not saying that French comics don't work, but it's another type of. It's not the same approach, you know. They do whole shows in theaters, but I have to say that going to clubs is really like going to the gym for, you know. You work out, you try, you craft the jokes, and for this reason I really loved it. And the second reason is, I am sure that in a club where I am not announced, there will be no one who knows me, and it will be a 100% crowd that is local. And maybe one or two people will know me, but I love the fact that in a club, because they didn't come for me, they didn't buy a ticket to see me, so they don't know me, they have no expectation, they don't know who I am, they don't even know I'm going to show up, and so it's going to be a pure and real and true reaction to my jokes.
You've been touring Canada, you're on the West Coast, and you're coming out here next week. And it strikes me that as Canadians, our sense of humor probably tends to be a little more European than what is funny to Americans down south. What have you noticed about
Totally.
the type of material that works for Canadian audiences?
It's a very interesting question because I've really noticed this every time I did shows in Canada, because it's a very tricky situation and very interesting for Canadians because they're so close to the US, but also so different. And they want to be different at some point, but for some point they don't want to be different. It's a very complex situation. But the thing is, the beauty of that, when I play in Canada and I make observation about Americans, when I say Americans, like US people, Canadians, it's really interesting. They are on my side observing and taking part on my side, with my perspective. And it's really interesting. When I do the same jokes in the US, it's more something of a self-deprecation that Americans would have. And, they're used to that, it's in their culture. But when I play in Canada, it's more, oh, we've noticed this. Even though we are Canadians, we are so close to them. You were born in Morocco, you come from France, you moved to America. Your perspective is really connected to our perspective. And I was really amazed because I said to my Canadian friends, you guys live there. How can you laugh about how crazy is that? The whole thing about the food, the whole thing about the workout, the whole thing about the guns, the whole thing. How can you laugh about that? You're so close. You. But because you're close, but you're so different, so you can share this perspective.
There's a lot of nuance that's present in comedy, and all different nuances come with different languages. What was the biggest challenge for you when you started performing in English versus performing in French?
The first one was a little detail. That seems like a detail, but it changes everything. Is I had to perform in front of people in clubs having burgers and beers and drinks and tacos. So I was not prepared. I'm not used to this because this doesn't even exist in France. You will never see someone, watching comedy and having a cheeseburger. So as a joke, I'll always tell them, I thought the language would be the challenge, but now I am competing with a burger. And it's hard for me because you're having a great cheeseburger and I have to make you laugh. So it's a little disturbing, the waiters and it's a whole atmosphere, but I got used to it. And now I can play with that and they're used to it. That was the first thing that really struck me, and I was so surprised. And the second thing is, I was wrong. When I moved to the US, I thought I would have to translate my best jokes in French, I mean in English, from French. And very quickly I realized that no, they need personal perspective, my opinion, my feelings, my vision. And I started to write material about what I was experiencing every day in the US, and it worked it really landed so hard. And I thought it was not even jokes, but they were so happy to see things in another angle, whether it is about the language, some little details about language that I've noticed and they never noticed. That's what happens, you know. I live in France. I mean, I used to live in France, and sometimes Americans would come and visit and they would tell me things about France that I had never seen before. That's the beauty of the outsider perspective.
But and then I know you did a Netflix special back in January that sort of mixed English and French. How did that go over with audiences, having that mix?
It was a good experience, and it was kind of a middle step to what I am doing now. I don't know if it's a, I don't know how the word middle. No, it was like a, I don't know. Sometimes I don't have the expression, but I'm sure you understand. Yeah. It was a intermediaire, you know, because now I'm having my special in English. It's all in English. We're taping it at Town Hall in New York City on November 18th. And it was kind of a first step with Netflix, and also try to tell this story not 100% in English, and maybe they wanted to know also if I, you know, but now I have my special all in English coming out in 2018, and we're taping it at the end of this month. I'm very happy to be part of all the those programs on Netflix, because all the comics I really admire are there, and being, you know, like lined up next to them, it's great. It's great. So I'm very, very happy of that. Very, I think, and also the special in English that is going to come out in 2018 is going to really showcase, we say, I don't know, showcase me, and because people don't know me, I have to be really honest with that, you know, like a few people now. But Netflix is going to help me doing more shows all over the country, and it's great.
And I
would say, there's one other thing, sorry to interrupt, there's one other thing I want to say about doing comedy in English, because we talk about a lot about the U.S., we talk about Canada, but the thing we never say and we forget is when you do comedy in English, you connect with the world. And I've been able to meet with comedians from Sri Lanka, from Egypt, from India, from Germany, because the common thing is the English language. And also we're able to perform there. The reason why, I don't know, Kevin Hart or Louis C.K. or Jerry Seinfeld could go tomorrow and play in Amsterdam or Copenhagen or Mumbai, it's because they speak English. And the French language that I love, and it's my mother tongue, and I really love French literature and French language, is limited to French territories. So English is, you know, it's, and now in some emerging countries, the stand-up in English is the thing, because they know, because it's in English, they have a voice.
Yeah. And then a month after the Netflix special aired, you played a sold-out show at Carnegie Hall. For someone like you who had, you know, was relatively new to North America, what was that experience like for you?
That was very strong. That was very, I was very, very honored and very happy. That's funny, because I called my mom that day and I said, can you believe I'm doing Carnegie Hall? And she had no idea what was Carnegie Hall. And she compared it to some venues in France and she said, is it better than the Olympia or not better? And then I said, oh yeah, it's crazy, mom, you have no idea. Then I said, Sinatra performed there. She said, oh, if Sinatra performed there, that's great. And she was so proud, and I was really proud and happy. That was a big moment also, because my friend Jerry Seinfeld that night made me a surprise on stage. He came up on stage as soon as I talked about him, because I have a joke about him. He showed up on stage and did a little bit with me on the stage. That was a crazy, crazy moment and a good memory. And I think it's something, it's a day, it's a night you don't forget in your career. I remember when I first did the Olympia in Paris. I remember when I did my first show in Montreal in 1994. And I remember when I did Carnegie Hall.
And I would imagine that you also remembered when you worked with Steven Spielberg. What was that experience like for you?
It was really really crazy. Of course, I could not even believe it when I got on the set. It was a weird situation because it was a motion capture shooting. So we were we had to wear all those outfits, like a combinaison with all those dots and electronics. And but being directed by him was such a, I was learning, you know, it was incredible. And what really impressed me, and I've noticed this with all like masters, big names, big talents, he was so calm, you know, calm and precise. I see this from only like a very, very important and talented and like icons, legend like him, you know. I had the same feeling with Woody Allen. I had the same feeling with him. It's just when they direct, they don't need to shout. They don't need to show you they know, because they know. They don't need to give you directions loud. And it's just little details that seem even like so simple, you know. But the thing is, I think in every form of art, you've worked so much and proved so much that you got to a point where what you do is very simple. Like painters, I love art, and they've been to some stages in their career where after 30 years, maybe they draw something so simple, but it's filled with all their story, their emotion, their talent, their what they say there, what they hide. And with directors and big names in comedy, like, I don't know, it's like big comedians, like big directors, like they don't need to prove to the world that, and they need to exist. So it's very serein. How you say serein? Serenity?
Calm, yes, like, yes, serene.
Serene, yeah. Serene. You just have to change a little bit the pronunciation and we're good.
You're coming to Toronto on Remembrance Day, November 11th, at the Queen Elizabeth Theatre. Gad Elmaleh, thanks so much for your time this morning.
Thank you so much for having me, and see you in Canada very, very soon.
All right, we'll see you soon. Ciao.
Bye-bye.
And that was my conversation with comedian Gad Elmaleh. His special Gad Gone Wild is on Netflix right now. And Gad will be appearing in Ottawa on November the 10th at the Centrepoint Theatre, at the Queen Elizabeth Theatre in Toronto on November the 11th, and at the Burton Cummings Theatre in Winnipeg on November the 12th. Okay, right now we have a song from Timber Tambor off of their album Sincerely Future Pollution. This is Sewer Blues.
I'll surrender to the fumes. go way back to you. I go way back through you, love. I go way back to you. I go way back through your love. They sing a money tune like a cigarette. Raise a roof above this room as the song repents. Order of the underground, as the sewer runs clear. Stretch your skin in front of me, undo every other year. But now I come for you, I come for you, womb. For your vapors and your perfume, for your fog-filled room, for your body and compass, for the body you adorn. As a bed is a necklace, as a mask is a horn. It's all flesh out, fleshed out and forgotten now. I'll go way back to you. I'll go way back through your blood. I'll go way back to you. I'll go way back through your blood.
In 2014, my guest's album was shortlisted for the Polaris Prize. That album was Hot Dreams. Their song Magic Arrow has been featured on Breaking Bad in the episode Caballo Sin Nombre, as well as in the TV series Good Wife. And Blackwater features on the soundtrack for the 2012 comedy For a Good Time Call. Their earlier album, Out of This Spark, was a longlist nominee for the 2009 Polaris Prize. And their fourth album, Creep On Creepin' On, was a shortlist nominee for the 2011 Polaris Prize. The band is Timber Tambor, and I spoke with keyboard player Matthew Charbonneau about their most recent album, Sincerely Future Pollution. I'm here with Matthew Charbonneau from Timber Tambor. Matthew, hello, welcome.
Thank you.
So, you guys have a new album out, Sincerely Future Pollution.
Yep.
How did this album start for you guys?
Well, it started off with Taylor bringing in some ideas and song ideas and song structures, and then three of us getting together in a space in Montreal and working on these songs and working on new sounds. And then after 3 months of actually being together almost every day, we went into the studio and recorded the record.
The title, seems very alludes, I think, in many ways to a possible future problem that we're seeing. What was the thought process behind that?
Well, I think while we were working on the record, all the stuff in the U.S. was happening. The campaign and the elections, all of that was kind of, it was the beginning of that stuff, and then it all seemed very absurd for us, and we didn't know what the outcome of that would be, and we actually we got the title and everything as a joke, but like it was a little like, you know, this dystopia that we're about to see will never happen, and then it did happen, and the title was already decided, so.
And I know the first single off the album is Sewer Blues. What can you tell us about that particular track?
I guess that was one of the first songs that came together. That was actually almost, yeah, close to a song. That was one of the first ones. And it's fairly quick to record in the studio. And I guess, lyrically speaking, it is a little bit, it's pretty close to what, you know, the meaning of the title and everything. I guess it would be, you know, it's gloomy and it's, it talks about a bit of like the, you know, the underworld.
You know, given the themes of that particular song, is that why there was a decision made to shoot the music video in black and white? Because I think it gives it a very different mood when something's in black and white versus color.
Yeah. I guess that was one of the reasons that the video was going to be in black and white. It was also, I think, a result of the discussion that we had with Cal Lemure, the director of the film. I think he works a lot in black and white, and it's all film. So he had that idea that we would use this black and white film, and he just come to the studio and film us. And then I guess the aesthetic was, you know, it was. In line with the song, yeah, the lyrics and everything.
And then your second single, which actually leads off the album, is "Velvet Gloves and Spit." I love the title of that. Where did that song come from?
I guess that was also one of the songs that we were playing early in the process, It has like it's kind of it's got more light, I would say, that song, in terms of musically speaking. For me anyways, it's lighter in textures and the sound and everything, and the structure also, the chords, you know, it's about you know, relationships, I guess, and but, you know, quirky. It's not super direct, I would say, in terms of I wouldn't say it's a love song, but it's, you know, there is some love and light.
the leading off the album with that song, that's going to be the song that people hear the most whenever they listen to a record. So what went into that thought process of deciding, okay, this is our single, but this is also going to lead off the album?
Let's start the record. We played around with a lot of different sequences to make the record. And there was a bunch of ways to go. We could like at one point we really had a darker beginning, where we had like the songs that would be had more like an industrial and dystopic feel. That was kind of the beginning of the record. And then we had all these brighter sounding songs too, that would, they were just coming after that, and like side B, I guess. And then at one point we decided that we wanted to start off, since like the listener would go through like, you know, some heavy, I guess, some heavy sounding stuff in terms of darker textures and themes and everything. So we were like, oh, let's start off easier and brighter, and then kind of move into that, you know, the underworld stuff. And that sequence kind of just stuck. It worked. It wasn't like, you know, it's kind of once you find a sequence and if it works, you just stick with it.
There's a lot of sort of darker themes on this record. What makes artists and writers sort of want to get in touch with that side of themselves, that side of society, touching on the darker areas of life?
Boy, I mean, that would be a, you know, a question best directed to Taylor. It's weird talking about like themes and lyrics, sure, and stuff like that. But if we're talking about sonic textures, it is fun, I think, to go into that kind of world and mood, because you can also, I think, in my experience, employ the lighter stuff and use it. So like, I feel that the palette is a little bit more complete if you're making music that's, I don't know, that's brighter. Then the dark stuff is harder, I think, to throw in there, if we're talking just, you know, musically.
Right. It also strikes me that you're a band that pays a lot of attention to aesthetics and in tone. What's that process like in terms of finding that balance in the music?
I guess every record we're always interested in new tones, and we try to find new instruments that will bring us like tones that we've never worked with before. And once you do that, then it kind of gives you new ideas to write differently. And they also influence what other people will play around you. So if you have a new tone, somebody else can do something different. So it's kind of a challenge that we kind of give ourselves, just to use new tones. And so this last record was definitely our goal was to, you know, go pretty deep into the use of synthesizers and really rare and old machines that we found in France where we did the record. The studio had some pretty weird stuff that we used, actually, and it kind of gave us ideas for other stuff. Yeah.
Given the a lot of the dystopian ideas of this record, and you know, you were recording it when all the stuff in the US happened, do you have hope for the future?
Oh yeah, definitely. Yeah, definitely. I do have hope for the future. You know, I have a daughter and stuff like that, so I think that's my job, to have hope for the future.
Would you say that you have a favorite track off of Sincerely Future Pollution?
Personal favorite? Tough question. I think one track that was, I think the track that I have worked the most in my entire life to make something that actually works. So the track that I've worked on the most is Grifting. From the beginning when we first heard the idea all the way to the end of the recording, and spent a lot of hours and listening back to that track in particular, I'm very happy because it's I didn't think it would work in like different stages of the process, because it was different and we worked so hard on it, but then it actually, I think it in the end, it worked, so it makes me happy. Yeah, I like that song a lot.
Well, the album is Sincerely Future Pollution, and Timber Temper is going to be in Toronto on November the 9th. Matthew Charbonneau, thanks so much for your time this morning.
Okay, thank you.
Alrighty, ciao. That was my conversation with Matthew Charbonneau from Timber Tambour. And here is Matthew's favorite track off Sincerely Future Pollution. This is Grifting.
Touches, touches, pushing, pulling, punches, ragged, bluffy, lunches, pulling off a fast one, riffing off the last one, reeling in the big one, fished in, fished in, grifting, grifting, grifting. Faking it to make it, never give, but take it, building trust through kindness to exploit the finest walls and bridges burning, time and table turning, double dipping, earning, lifted, lifted, grifting, grifting, grifting. Brick by brick, unbuilt and grift. the true believer, grifter, great achiever, grifter, great deceiver, grifting, 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 grifting.
That was Grifting by Timber Tambor off of their album Sincerely Future Pollution. My final guest is a performing artist, painter, curator, composer, filmmaker, and writer who achieved notoriety in the 1980s as a member of Brooklyn's prevalent drag scene as a genderqueer artist, but currently resides in Berlin, Germany. She is part of a new exhibit at the New Museum in New York City entitled Trigger, Gender as a Tool and as a Weapon. She is Vaginal Davis, and I spoke with her a week ago. Vaginal Davis, hello, welcome.
Oh, I feel very welcome.
So you're part of a really interesting new exhibit happening in New York called Trigger, Gender as a Tool and as a Weapon. How did you become involved with this collective?
Well, the people from the museum, the curator just contacted me and wanted to include some sculpture pieces that I had in a solo show in New York back in 2015 at my gallery. My New York gallery is called Invisible Exports on the Lower East Side, and they're the New York City gallery that represents me. And I had in 2015, I had a solo show of my sculpture pieces called "Come On, Daughter, Save Me," and that phrase, "Come On, Daughter, Save Me." It's a phrase that my mother used to always say all the time, which is really, it's a funny phrase that also one of my old-time collaborators, who's also a Canadian, Glenn Meadmore from Winnipeg, Canada, we collaborated on the punk rock band in the early 90s called Pedro Miro and Esther, and that's a phrase that his mother also used, called "Come On, Daughter, Save Me," and that's like we both shared this phrase of our mothers referring to us in that way of "Come on, daughter, save me," and that's when I decided to title my solo show at Invisible Exports in 2015 with that title, and the actual show from 2015, it included my about 25 of my sculpture pieces or art objects, and also a recording, an acetate recording that of this sort of allegorical text, you know. But for the Trigger show, they just wanted to utilize the art objects, the sculpture pieces. They just wanted those for this big, gigantic exhibition with, you know, over 50 artists around the world. It's a really huge, huge exhibition, you know.
Yeah.
And so when they asked me to be a part of it, you know, they also went through my gallerist, and because the gallerist had to like go and get all the sculpture pieces from the people the collectors who bought them and whatnot, and borrow, and so that the museum could borrow those sculpture pieces and put them in this show. But I was glad that, you know, it worked out, and they made the arrangements, and the pieces were put in Trigger.
And I know you also have I read that you have a special performance in there entitled Gaze and Desire. What's that all about?
Oh yeah, they also wanted me to do a little performance piece as part of the public program for Trigger, and the Gaze and Desire performance piece that I did was sort of like a little meditation about a lot of the things that are happening now in the world and my unique take on what's happening, you know. And so it was a performance piece with the music, and I'm reading text, and I'm sort of like confronting the audience, but not in a real dogmatic like way. I sort of like confront the audience in a very playful like way. But you know, I talk a lot about how, you know, things have changed, especially with these boutique cities like New York, and you know, Toronto is another boutique city, and Los Angeles, the city where I was born and raised, and San Francisco and London, Paris, and how advanced capitalism and danger capitalism are just turning all these cities, you know, more or less, they're all becoming sort of like the same, and they're just losing, you know, what made these cities more interesting by everything only being about the wealthy and people, you know, of privilege and whatnot. So in my performance, I'm sort of like making this sort of commentary in a somewhat whimsical, humorous, doing it in a whimsical, humorous approach.
You know,
with music.
Yeah, for sure. I was just going to say, you mentioned there that you're sort of commenting on a lot of what's going on in the world. And I know for years, as part of your work, you've critiqued oppression within the system and sort of how the system works. And with all that we're seeing and talking about right now, like with the sexual harassment allegations and all the political strife, are we finally starting to see that system crack and break down a little bit, do you think?
Well, I think that there are slowly there's these factors, these people who are coming together, that people like there's a lesbian feminist group called the Madame Defarges, and they also have resistance leaders, these intersex resistance leaders in the field called the Fist of Diana. And a lot of these sort of secret lesbian and intersex feminist warriors are working sort of behind the scenes to sort of like pull the sort of status quo apart. And they're working very secretively, and that's how things are going to start to finally change. And you know, in my performance, Gaze and Desire, I mention the Madame Defarges and their sort of their comrades in arms, the Fist of Diana. And I think that it's great that there's all these groups that are coming together. A lot of them kind of operate very secretively. And with the work that I do, it's about like making commentary, doing it in a very whimsical like way, and not being dogmatic with it, but you know, still the point gets around, you know, through humor.
And I know that one of the things that when I was reading up on Trigger, one of the things that talked about was how that the fluid conception of gender is marked by ongoing negotiations of power. And I'm curious whether you think as we come to better understand how gender is a spectrum and the fluidity of it, how you think that will affect power dynamics and maybe ultimately change societal structures going forward, if at all.
Well, I think that one has to sort of overthrow the dominant structures and not feel that just by being only a part of these structures that you can form it to change. I think that there has to be something more. There has to be something completely new, and that's why I don't really believe so much in institutions, because institutions change you. You don't change the institution. So if you become part of these institutions, you just get sucked up in the machinery of these various institutions. So I feel that you have to sort of dismantle these institutions and get rid of them. And like I said, there are these elements out there that are working on doing just that, and doing it in a clandestine like way. And pretty soon there will be a reckoning. Let's put it that way. There'll be a reckoning.
One, I think, important aspect is intersectionality, and that's something that a lot of young people are getting involved in today as well. How important is intersectionality when we're talking about gender and sexuality?
Oh, well, yeah, that's very important, because, there needs to be various groups coming together and realizing that putting about this kind of change, you can't do it by yourself. You need others out there. You need allies, and you need support. And I think that when this interregnum does happen, people are going to be quite surprised at all the various groups in this intersectionality who are coming together and who are working closely with each other. People that you wouldn't think would be in quite this way, because it's involving people from a lot of various backgrounds and also social classes who are joining force, and not just social class, but also gender, racially, who are working together as allies with a lot of people who are underprivileged and who see the necessity for making this big change. And I think that it's going to hit a lot of people by surprise when it all comes to fore.
I know that the title of Trigger, it can evoke a lot of emotions in people, like whether it's a warning or a power play. And I know that one criticism that a lot of the younger generation gets is that how they're, oversensitive or hypersensitive to nearly everything. What do you make of that call, that we're living in a hypersensitive age compared to where we used to be 15, 20 years ago?
Well, everything changes, but I don't really, I work with a lot of young people. I mentor, I get invited by colleges and universities and art schools to do my sort of nutty seminars and workshops. And yes, there are some very privileged young people who sort of live in a little privileged bubble. But then there are others who are more like the way I was when I was young, who challenge things, and they challenge their elders, and they can see the inequities. And they don't want to just follow. They could just easily be like their middle class parents or whatever, the upper middle class family, and just become exactly clones of them. But they want something different. They want change. They want to be around a world that is completely embracing, and even if it means that they go completely against their family and the following the tenets that their family has instilled in them, that they want to get away from that. And these are people from very privileged backgrounds and from very they're the children. There's the children of immaculate lost wealth, a lot of them. And it's because of these intersectionalities of these children from these kinds of backgrounds that come from money and privilege that sort of reject where their family comes from. And they're joining forces with those of us who come from nothing. And it's because of, so I don't see it as, I think that people who want just little sound bites to say that, they're so easily trigger warned. They need, you know, they have to have trigger warnings. All these young people are so sensitive. I think that there may be some people who are definitely that way, but I don't think that that's everyone. I think that there are, you know, I find these kindred spirits of these young people who are very much like the way I was, that they want to challenge authority. You know, they don't want to just accept authority. And I find these people, and they're young people who are very, very inquisitive, and they're searching. They're really, really, really sincere in their searching. And they really, they put themselves out there. And I see both sides to the equation. I don't want to just harp on the negative. I always like to think in terms of positivity.
You mentioned you live in Berlin, and it strikes me that Berlin has become a bit of a haven for, you know, performance art and a lot of people that challenge the system. What do you think it is about that city? What do you like about it?
Well, I left Los Angeles, where I was born and raised. I was born and raised in Los Angeles, California, one of the few natives of Los Angeles. Most people come to LA from God knows where. They all come there to become something in the entertainment industrial complex. They all want to become film stars or rock stars or something in the entertainment world. People come there for these kinds of dull dreams that they have, and that system of things, that system sort of perpetuates people coming to a city like Los Angeles. But you know, I rejected all that because I grew up and was raised in Los Angeles. And I rejected what Los Angeles offers in terms of the mainstream entertainment and industrial complex. And, you know, I moved here to Berlin in 2005. And as I could see the writing on the wall of the way that cities like Los Angeles were heading in this boutique manner, this boutique way, I could see that they were going in this hideous direction, and a lot of other cities around the world were heading in this direction. And Berlin was like one of the last cities that was, you know, at the time that I moved here in 2005, that rents were very reasonable, the cost of living was low, you didn't have to like be working five or six jobs just to like pay, you know, exorbitant rent and whatnot. And Los Angeles had been like that before. You know, LA had been one of the major cities in the world that had really low cost housing, because for the longest time, you know, I had a huge apartment in Los Angeles that I only paid, like, you know, have three bedrooms. You know, I made my movies out of there, I did my rehearsing there. You know, a three bedroom apartment I had in Koreatown section of Los Angeles, I only paid $500 a month. And you know, up until I got gentrified out of that apartment in 2005, you know, I had never paid more than $500 a month rent. And most of the time, living in LA, my rent was between, like, let's say, like around $250 to $400 in a month rent. And it's just unfathomable how the rents have increased in a city like LA, and this evility towards, you know, and the homeless situation. The last time when I was invited back to LA in the summer to perform at the Broad Museum, there's all these like homeless encampments and tents everywhere. It's just horrible because they've taken all the single room occupancy hotels, which was like sort of like the last place for low income people, and they're turning them all into luxury lofts and whatnot. You know, it's just really, 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 really hateful. This, you know, but Berlin, when I came in, of course, now Berlin is creeping up to the same level of a lot of the other, a lot of these boutique cities. Berlin is, the rents are creeping up, and there's all these problems now with people getting kicked out of their apartment. And I just found out that the apartment that I have, where I pay very little rent, has just been sold, and there's going to be a new owner. So I'm a little bit, luckily, the laws here are very, very strong, and they're more geared toward renters' rights as opposed to property owners' rights. But still, I'm a little bit fearful knowing what happened to me when I got gentrified out of Los Angeles. I'm a little bit fearful. But, you know, I think what's been drawing people to Berlin is the history of Berlin. You know, it's very, very deep, the history. So people are drawn here by this history, the fact that Berlin was this divided city. If there was this sort of they created this sort of fake Western presence here during the divide, you know, because all of Berlin is really the East, but you know they just created this fake Western presence here, and then all the people that didn't really fit into the traditional German family structure, and people who live outside of the traditional German way in the other parts of Germany, all those people back in the 80s and 90s, they all wound up living here in Berlin. So Berlin has always sort of stayed kind of separate in a way, and this different sort of structure here in Berlin. And of course, also back in the 80s, if you lived in Berlin and you were from another part of Germany, you didn't have to go into the military service here. And then they also paid people a stipend to live in the city to keep that fake Western presence. So I think that's another reason why Berlin has always been somewhat different from the other parts of Germany and other parts of Europe. And so because of that lore, that history, that's attracted people. And then about the time that I moved here, between around 2001, when the Cheap Collective, the art collective that I was a part of that started in 2001, that was about the same time when Berlin just started to become really well known on the world map, where people started to like take notice of Berlin, and you know, like the New York Times was writing about Berlin almost in the Sunday section of the New York Times. Almost every Sunday there was something about Berlin opera, Berlin theater, this about Berlin. Berlin was just becoming more talked about in the early 2000s. And then by the time that I moved here in 2005, I think that was when a lot of people started to like really take Berlin a lot more seriously. And so it does have this lure and this lore, Berlin, and it led me here. And I already had an infrastructure because I've been working with a group of, you know, talk about intersectionality. I already have been working with a group of Germans and expats that formed the Cheek Collective with the German intermedia actress and director Susanna Zoxa, who stars in a lot of Bruce LaBruce's films. She's like the fearless leader of the Cheek Collective. And so I was really fortunate that I had people like Susanna who took me under their wing, and I had an infrastructure here to do my work within, you know, because other than that, I would have been completely like lost, because at the time when I moved here, you know, usually if you move to different countries, you do that when you're quite young. You don't really do that when you're a bit older. So it was really something for me to be able to come here and have an infrastructure and to have that kind of support, which I definitely did not get back in the States, and especially in a city like Los Angeles. You know, I was living in Los Angeles, a city of cars, when I never learned how to drive a car. It's a city where most people all have cars, and I've always taken public transportation. I've always ridden a bicycle or walked. I've never owned a car in my life. And I would never want to own a car. To me, that's just like, oh, so revolting to own a car. And here in Berlin, you don't really need a car. So the last 7 or 8 years, I'm noticing there's more and more people getting cars, which is really distressing to see that. And the traffic has just gotten really horrible in the last 7 or 8 years as more people get cars, and especially those icky American-style SUVs. Like, I don't know why anyone would want to have one of those kinds. If you're going to get a car, why would you want to even get an SUV? Those things are just so hideous, those hideous creatures, those SUVs. And there's more people with SUVs now, and that's very distressing, you know. But there's still a lot of people there's the bike lanes here. Everyone's on a lot of people are riding their bicycle. And I fit right into that, because that's how I basically got around in Los Angeles, was riding my bicycle, even though people thought it was extremely odd to be riding a bicycle, because they didn't really have a bicycle culture in Los Angeles during the time, you know, that I lived there and growing up in Los Angeles. Now they do, because there's that critical mass movement, and there is a bicycle culture in Los Angeles, which is really quite nice to know about.
Yeah. Well, the show is Trigger, Gender as a Tool and as a Weapon, and it's showing now at the New Museum in New York until January 21st. Vaginal Davis, thanks so much. Thanks so much for your time today.
Well, thank you so much for contacting me, and it was a real pleasure talking with you.
All right.
Bye.
Bye. That was my conversation with artist Vaginal Davis. The exhibit that she's a part of is called Trigger, Gender as a Tool and as a Weapon, which is being featured now at the New Museum in New York City. My thanks to Matthew Charbonneau from Timber Tambor. Their new album, Sincerely Future Pollution, is out now. And my thanks to Gad Elmaleh, who will be performing in Ottawa on November the 10th, Toronto on November the 11th, and Winnipeg on November the 12th. And thank you, Roy. We'll miss you. We're going to take you out with Velvet Gloves and Spit. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you next time. Bye for now.
I could not release the inspiration till you asked me to. Came at your body relentlessly throughout the year. Or too far away, too near the shore, this honey moon. I was a stranger, too familiar and not enough. But I once saw the touch of your velvet hand upon my face. I recall velvet gloves and spit in your embrace, and I wanted nothing else. The haunted hotel room, the two-bit man child. I could not simply fall asleep next to you every night. Our castle in the sand, built too high too soon. And under waving palms and waving sails and waves, goodbye. Well, I once saw the touch of your velvet hand upon my face. I recall velvet gloves and spit and your embrace. Oh, I once saw the touch of your velvet hand upon my face. But I recall velvet gloves and spit in your embrace, and I wanted nothing else.